In this episode, I managed to genuinely upset my host with the suggestion that the Greeks are boring. But first, some poetry.
As men talk in a dream, so Corinth all, throughout her palaces imperial, and all her populous streets and temples lewd, muttered like tempest in the distance brewed, to the widespreaded night above her towers. Men, women, rich and poor, in the cool hours, chuffered their sandals over the pavement white, companioned or alone, while many a light flared here and there from wealthy festivals, and threw their moving shadows on the walls, or found them clustered in the corniced shade of some arched temple door or dusky colonnade. And that, of course, as all our listeners will immediately know, was Keats.
I thought it wasn't ancient Greek.
Yes, I'm afraid the ancient Greek for that would be so far beyond me as to be slightly absurd. But that's Keats and Lamia talking about Corinth. And I think that Corinth is a good city to focus on in this podcast. And perhaps you could explain why.
I have no idea why Corinth is a good city to focus on in this podcast. But to back up, my question was, because he's really into the Greeks. Ancient Greeks, Greek culture, Greek language.
Yeah, I like the Greeks. Yeah,
philosophy, all that stuff. And my problem is that they seem, from the outside, to be a bit boring. To explain myself, if you look at, you know, old art from other cultures, you know, like Aztec or African or Assyrian or you know, classical Indian, you know, there's always a sense of the transcendent there, or a sense of the spiritual, or a sense of something weird going on.
Well, if you look at, I actually cannot believe what I'm hearing.
If you look at Greek art, it's like just a really good statue of a person, and there's not much else going on there. And this sort of extends to what we read from the Greeks, where instead of these kind of wild, you know, religious tracts, you end up with Socrates and Plato having quite civilized discussions that are extremely rational and very relatable to today, and not bonkers, which is what I want.
Well, you really think that? Do you really find Plato sort of rational and sane?
Well, I think he's approaching generally mundane subjects in a way that is relatable to us. Like
he thinks that philosophers should be king in a sort of philosophic autocracy.
Yeah, but I mean, the fact that what he's talking about is how to run a successful government rather than you know, why is the sky so big?
I cannot tell you how wrong you are about this. And I was worried I'd be preaching to the converted, actually, when you suggested this topic about why the Greeks are weird and awesome. Awesome is my word there. I can now see that actually there's plenty of work to get stuck into here.
Some white space. So I'm aware of dissenting opinions here. That there's a book called The Greeks and the Irrational by E.R. Dodds that I'd be made to read at some point.
1952, very old now.
Yeah, exactly. So I didn't really understand it. I can only really cope with blog posts at this point.
I mean, the translations of things like the Iliad and the sort of standard Peregrine texts are all from the sort of the early 50s, just as a by-the-by. And sometimes that makes, you look up their sort of the choices they've made for the translation of various words and you think, wow. Anyway, right, well, where to begin? Well, I think that...
Corinth.
Corinth.
Of course.
Yeah, well, why would I want to talk about Corinth? Well, here's a fact about Corinth. In Strabo, he says that the Temple of Aphrodite at Corinth was so wealthy that it had 1,000 prostitute slaves, who were prostitutes, all there to make money for the goddess. So, I mean, you know, I'd say that this is a pretty distant and alien culture where you are having, you know, as a very much a sanctioned religious activity, the sort of the prostitution there. And actually, I think that it's fair to say that people have taken these couple of lines of Strabo, and a lot of historians have decided to run quite far with it. It's almost like they like thinking about it. And I think that the consensus is now that there definitely weren't 1,000 in the temple. I think that somebody sort of tried to work it out and thinks that you'd get 100 in at most.
How much space does one need?
Yeah, well, I don't know the exact metrics of the calculation, but I think it's of an order of magnitude that, you know, it's we can be pretty certain there weren't 1,000 there. But I think that probably the explanation for that is even stranger, in that these, you know, these 1,000 slaves were probably a donation of property to the temple, rather in a similar way that wealthy people might donate sort of money or other things to a religious institution today.
Sort of endowment.
The Temple of Aphrodite.
Because you could create a brothel today and call it the Temple of Aphrodite, and that would work fine.
There was definitely a big temple of Aphrodite.
So it was definitely a religious institution.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, 100%. You know, there's multiple sources for that. There's Pausanias. I think the archaeological remains are there, and you know, it's all pretty secure.
It was a long time ago.
it was a long time ago, but I would say that immediately there you're in an extremely different world. You know, certainly nobody at the time is thinking there's anything amiss about that. Which is immediately we're in a very different religious context, we're in a very different social context, and I think that that's a healthy corrective to the idea that the Greeks are these sort of slightly worthy, rational old men, exclusively thinking about rather dull topics. There's so much weirdness in ancient Greek religion. I mean, where to begin? Do you want to hear about the naming festival?
Yes, I would love to hear about the naming festival.
Festival's the wrong word, actually. It's a ceremony. naming ceremony. I mean, there's a surprising amount of scholarly debate about this, so I'm just going to do my best to sort of tread through the various thickets.
Go for it. I'm stoked.
Called the Amphidromia, which in Greek sort of carries a notion of sort of running around. You'd imagine, you're in ancient Greece, your child is born. Yeah, you're a woman, your child is born. You've almost certainly been kept in what is essentially a prison inside the house called the gynaikon, because you're a female. The Greeks were, well, certainly the rich ones, were not pro-female, I think it's fair to say. They weren't allowed. They were kept within a particular room in the house, just so they didn't accidentally bump into any male who they weren't related to or married to.
And that is how a lot of Arabic houses run themselves these days, especially in Yemen and the more conservative places.
Yes, and you love Arabic society, so there you go. That's immediately there's something you can relate to there.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that lock women up in a good icon.
You bump into your mate's wife. I mean, that'd be...
Yeah.
That'd be horrendous. Really awkward.
you're up there probably, you're giving birth. There'll be a midwife there. The child won't be presented to the father for at least 5 days, and the sources differ as whether it's 5 or 7 or 10. But and the thinking was goes that the weak children will die before then, and it's a sad reality that I think it's something like half of all children will be dead before they're 5 in the ancient world.
Yeah, I mean, similar statistics rather more recently in most of the world that isn't Western Europe.
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting. A lot of cultures where you don't name your child until they're 2 years old, because why bother? Yeah.
Well, yes. I mean, and it's basically a similar thing that's going on here. Have you heard of the child sacrifice stuff in Phoenician settlements, the Tophets? This is off course, but
is that Moloch and all that?
Yeah. A lot of they think that actually, there's something like the remains of sort of 20,000 infants in the Tophet in Carthage. But actually, a lot of them weren't have been alive when they were sacrificed. A lot of them have been, sadly.
Oh, already dead. Died. So you can test it, because I always thought it was, gleefully feeding your babies into the flames. They might already have been dead. Children that died of natural causes.
I think that's the latest thinking. I've just read David Abulafia, who's usually pretty sound on these kind of things.
He is sound.
But I actually don't think they would be gleeful about it either. I mean, I think the whole point is that it's the most sort of profound sacrifice that you can make. which goes to the heart of the weirdness of sacrifice. But yeah, it's a slightly different thing. Obviously, the Phoenicians are not Greek. Although, funnily enough, the Greeks saw them as sort of like anti-Greeks. So they're very similar, but also uncannily different.
Because Phoenicians are Northwest Africa. I always thought of them in the same frame as ancient Rome, but I hadn't really thought about them in the same frame as ancient Greece.
Well, initially they're actually from the Levant, so they're sort of culturally they're sort of Canaanites, and then you know they come from Tyre, for example, and there's a few other cities up and down that coast, but Tyre was particularly powerful, and they sent out colonies, and you know Carthage is sort of Phoenician for new city. Carthashit or something like that. And then it's a colony, and then, you know, they just basically colonized. Exactly like the Greeks. But they were there before them.
Okay. And were south of it, so had different currents in the Mediterranean, so they went in a different direction.
Yeah, although the currents go up and around Rhodes, so they were taking the same routes westward as the Greeks were, because you can't go west along the coast of Africa. You have to go west, basically south of the Peloponnese, and then up the west coast of Greece, and then across to Sicily, and then from there you can go across to what is modern day Tunisia, and then further to the Pillars of Hercules at Gibraltar.
Okay,
So they do kind of come into conflict. It's to do with the currents and so the currents going to go counterclockwise around the eastern Mediterranean.
Okay.
Anyway,
where was the ancient Greeks?
They. The naming ceremony, the Amphitryona. Yeah. Right, so 5 to 7 days after the child is born, and it survived, hopefully, they had this ceremony where the child is sort of ritually introduced into the household. And it's not quite clear whether they're sort of put on the central hearth or whether they, and people run around them.
At the central hearth, so the fireplace is in the middle of the room, or...
Yes, it's probably central conceptually rather than physically, I think.
Okay.
It's the ritual center of the house. I'm just thinking of, in my mind's eye, I haven't quite thought of it in these terms before.
So it's more an altar than a fireplace?
Yes, well, I mean, because there's a goddess of the hearth, Hestia, who's quite an important goddess. So, yes, it's a sort of ritual center within the house. I think that its location was dependent on the house, as it were.
Mm.
It's not quite clear whether the child is placed in the center or whether they're carried around it. I think most people think they're carried around it. So the sort of the father, people think, the sources, as I say, are very quite unclear. The father runs around carrying the child and runs around a few times. And I think it seems that they did this naked, which is an interesting detail. And yes, and it also seems that there was something to do with cuttlefish being sent as well. So people would send cuttlefish.
Of course.
And those are the sort of, those are the tantalizing details that we have. And I think that, you know, I think that in that, you know, there are some questions raised there. And I think that it's, you know, just conjuring any kind of scenario that's built out of those fragmentary details in one's mind's eye is a healthy corrective to the idea that these are sort of dull people only talking about sort of... political theory.
Yeah, I guess the question then comes, how come they talk so well on political theory when in their spare time they're running around naked with babies and giving cuttlefish to each other?
Well, you see, this is the other weirdness and the other completely fascinating thing about ancient Greece, which is that culturally they are very, very unified. They're very, very clear that they are Greeks and they have a very clear boundary.
Even though they're split into like these city-states that are at war with each other.
Exactly.
That's like warring between siblings and they know that the Persians are something completely different.
Exactly. Well, it's and some scholars think that actually it is the Persian wars that create this sense of strong cultural unity. To be fair, it's not clear that it really existed much before then.
Mm.
But although actually I would argue that the you know, if we're getting anything historical coming down through the sort of the Iliad, then it might suggest some sort of notion of cultural unity before then, but that's quite tenuous. But
should we back up a little bit here for people who aren't aren't intimately familiar with the chronology of the formation of
who's that?
Classical Greece. Yeah, I mean, obviously,
wait, who are these people?
Not our listeners, but they might share this with their friends. And,
yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. We have the, ancient Greece, right. Yeah. You've got the Mycenae, basically the first sort of proto-city-states form in the Mycenae, what's called the Mycenaean Age. It's called that after the city of Mycenae. And that's basically late Bronze Age. And so we're talking, 1600 to 1200 BC. Mm. And then there's something called the Bronze Age collapse that happens around 1200 BC, which is an extremely mysterious event that seems to have either been caused by or has precipitated, huge movements of peoples, massive economic disruption, and basically the entering into a new dark age. This is when we get the records out of Egypt saying, the sea peoples tried to invade, and everyone's like, well, who are these sea peoples? Well, it's most likely the Sea Peoples are Mycenaeans and possibly people from Anatolia and, sort of what became Asia Minor, who are being basically climate / economic refugees.
It's a bit like the Vikings more recently.
Yes, yeah. And like many, there are any number of comparisons, actually. This is actually quite a normal phenomenon once the sort of shipbuilding technology is at a sufficient stage, actually, and it's quite normal for people to just set sail.
Yeah,
yeah.
Let's go.
Once things get too hairy at home, but it's not quite clear what precipitates it all. But there is this huge like Volkwanderung, as the German scholars would call it, which is huge movement of peoples in the north and. It's all very unclear because, obviously our sources are...
Yeah, it is a dark age. I find this fascinating because it's common to think that history is all about development and things steadily get better and better and more advanced and more advanced. But actually, if you look back, we hit these peaks of civilization and then everything just collapses and then it's darkness for a few centuries and then you might get another peak. Maybe that peak's higher, maybe not. The ancient Egyptians are the classic example where you have the dynastic periods where they're building pyramids and making hieroglyphs, and then you have the interdynastic periods, which come after 50 years of that, where they're all just trying to scrape a living, and then no one has enough time to do anything creative at all.
Yeah, then, it's really weird as well, because if you think about it, if you're a Greek, say, living in the Dark Age, then you're surrounded by the ruins of a former civilization, which displays technological abilities that you can't even imagine. So you're looking at these walls that have been built around Mycenae with these stones that are, they're absolutely massive. I don't know whether you've ever seen them or ever been, but they're huge.
I never have.
The Greeks who were living there in the shadow of the ruins thought that they'd been built by cyclops, monsters, because they couldn't conceive of how men. And so when you think about, and then when you get trying to get into the psychology of someone who's living in those circumstances, because we're so used to the notion of history, we have this kind of Whiggish view of history, whether we like it or not, and some people say they don't, but they do, where, generally things, technological power increases over time, and things, human beings get more powerful, more knowledgeable, more productive over time, and that's, we almost think of that as a kind of immutable law of the universe, but of course if you were, that's a real base, layer of our psychology and the way we see the world, but if you were a Greek living in the shadow of Mycenae in the Dark Age around 950 BC, then history goes in the completely different direction. The past was glorious and had these unknown mysteries and this this almost unfathomable technological excellence, or was full of monsters who were either way were much more powerful than you are, and you are the kind of the lesser generations living in their shadow, and things get worse.
The Anglo-Saxons had the same. There's a great poem by some Anglo-Saxon guy wandering around some Roman ruins, and it's just like, what giants built these, and what incredible parties they must have had.
Yes. I really like how he's got real to the heart of that, actually.
Yeah.
Think of the parties. Anyway, that's what I think of when I read about the culture, you want to go to the parties.
This opens up the possibility that we are blind to signs of perhaps an even older civilization that reached greater peaks than ours. We just don't recognize them because we think that we're the best there's ever been.
Yeah. Well, we think that, you know, all these solar systems that act like clocks and have planets in them are perfect for habitation. We're just thinking, oh, it's just physics playing itself out. Maybe not.
Yeah.
It was all that. Yeah. Anyway.
The giants built this.
Yeah. well, it's that idea, isn't it? The explanation of the paradox. What's he called? Fermat? You know, Fermi, yeah. Fermi's paradox. The explanation for that is that we can see the aliens all around us. It's just that they're so advanced that we don't recognize it.
Not very relatable,
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway.
But think about how
different your view of the world and reality would be if you think that power decreases and that you are the lesser generation after a previous glorious generation. I mean, it would be a very different world.
Very different mind you have, yeah.
I think it would almost feel like time was going backwards. If we were to suddenly somehow shift ourselves into that mindset, I think it would feel to us as if the hour of time had been reversed. I genuinely do think that. And I'm not willing to articulate or explain that any further. because I don't think I can. Yeah. But anyway, you have the Bronze Age collapse around 1200 BC. Basically, in the archaeological record, there's just a kind of a layer of ash, to put it crudely. Yeah. Slightly more nuanced than that. But nobody really knows really why, but there it is. and then you have a sort of dark age that lasts at least 400 years where, you know, no stone buildings are being built. Nothing is being written down. You did have a form of writing in the Mycenaean age. You had linear A and linear B. We've cracked linear B. Nobody still can quite work out linear A. And basically all they were writing down was their sort of records of what's in their storehouses. We're not really getting poetry or anything like that. But then there's no writing at all, hence Dark Age. We have no sources, no stone buildings, very, very little archaeological evidence at all. It's not really clear what's going on.
So it's just extremely poor people just subsistence farming and trying to survive the winter.
Yeah, I mean, even the pottery becomes... They call it sub-Mycenaean.
Nice.
And for what little they find. Anyway, around 800 BC, you start to get the sort of the green shoots of what we would think of as organized societies and sort of economic power.
And we're sort of talking some stone buildings and some bronze implements lying around.
We're talking about the first identifiable rebuilding of centers of power in sort of defensible locations, and the first it's the rebuilding of the kind of the big stone things on the top of the hill, and we're only really talking about things that are the size of a sort of a three-bed house, and that's the kind of the biggest fortress for miles around kind of thing, but it is nevertheless shows that organization is happening again, because you have to organize the labor in order to do that. And that shows that, and so is that sort of thing is going on.
More food than they need to survive the winter.
Yeah. And basically sometime in between 800 and 700 BC, you also get the first, the Greeks start using the writing system. They adapt it from the Phoenicians.
So they're not using the Mycenaean writing system. They're using completely
They're using a new one, which has basically been imported from the East. But the crucial innovation is that they not only have symbols for consonants, but they also, the Greeks introduced symbols for vowels as well. And basically, in Phoenician, you have these kind of guttural stops, and the Greeks said, well, we can just use some of the symbols for that for vowels and add in a few of a new one. And suddenly, for the first time, you had an alphabet that matches, has a symbol basically for any sound that the voice box can create. So that's the first time that's happened.
Okay.
And so, you only have to learn, 26, whatever it is, instead of, 5,000 or,
or higher 13, but you're not quite sure what it says.
Yes, exactly. 13, but you're not quite sure whether it's, Yahweh or, your donkey. Yeah. They have that, and at almost the exact instant that alphabet is formulated and sort of spread, you get the creation of the Iliad and the Odyssey,
So that was just as we were coming out of the Dark Age.
Yeah, it's sometime. But I think the consensus now is that it's sometime between 800 and 700 BC. And actually, people keep pushing it kind of further towards us rather than further back in time. So I think people now are quite comfortable with the idea of Homer being around in 700 BC. Whereas even when we were at university, it was 850 BC. Yeah. So anyway, but these poems are actually oral poems. They've come from an oral tradition, and they tell of stories basically that are set in the Mycenaean Age.
Okay, stories of the Mycenaean Age written around 700. So is that when they were recorded in writing, or they were first told and then they were recorded in writing later?
Well, the fascinating thing is that as best as we can tell, these stories have been told since the last Ice Age. So it's an oral tradition that goes back as far back as we can glimpse.
So it's not like a modern poet talking about what happened a few hundred years ago. It is someone saying the same story that was said a few hundred years ago. Is that?
Well, it's a living oral. You have to imagine So there's a kind of a canon of stories.
Yeah.
That gets told and retold by basically. I mean, we think of them as professional storytellers who remember it all. They just remember it, and it kind of comes in these chunks which you can kind of cut and paste and put in different ways in there. But we know that it goes back into deep time, because when you look at Gilgamesh, which is this other epic poem that we have from many thousands of years before, that was written down in a kind of a previous and much much more clunky alphabet, we get some of the exact same details that we get in the Iliad. So there's a grand hero, his friend dies, and his friend comes to him a dream. He tries to embrace him three times, but he can't because he's just a phantom. The exact same thing happens in the Iliad, and that's pretty specific.
Well, yeah, Jung would say, just that image looked in everyone's subconscious, part of our racial memory.
It's too
shared heritage. For
that. Yeah, well, it's actually just a continuous tradition. It's the same stories being told and retold. And so what you get in the Iliad and the Odyssey is basically a very, very mature and sophisticated oral tradition of storytelling that for some reason gets written down. And it's absolutely, it's the best thing that's ever been written. And it's the first thing that really was ever written.
Do you think it changed when it got written down?
Yeah, like almost certainly. Almost certainly. Because if you were to read the Iliad, say, aloud, it would take you about 24 hours.
Yeah.
So clearly this new tool of writing allowed a particularly genius oral poet to think, right, now I can really go to town. Yeah. And just happened to create the greatest thing ever. it's absolutely perfect. So that kicks off the what's called the archaic era of ancient Greece, where you get the first city states reforming for a few centuries.
Yeah.
And then that slowly develops into what's called the classical period, which kicks off around 500 BC.
So and that's kind what of have, we all think of.
And that's where you, of, yeah. you know, what we would say the polis, the Greek polis, the city, yeah. the city state is maturing into its kind of its most fluorescent form, should we say?
Yeah.
And that is, that is the era of it kicks off with the wars against Persia, the famous Persian invasions that are repelled. And if you've seen sort of 300 and so forth, that's when all that
I have seen 300
jazz is happening. I mean, I love that film. I'm not going to lie.
It's a great film.
And you have the Peloponnesian War, which American strategists love talking about, the Thucydides trap and all of that kind of stuff. And the first really proper historian who's Thucydides was writing about that. So you get the invention of history. I mean, obviously it starts with Herodotus, but Thucydides is the first kind of proper historian. That's not to do Herodotus down. I mean, he was a genius, but Thucydides is the first recognizably modern historian, and it's shocking how modern he is. You're just getting the things like the invention of history, philosophy, politics, democracy, pretty much left, right and center, like just all the time for about 100 years, really between 500 and 400 BC. And some of the absolutely most fundamental things that define Western culture are all sort of dreamt up and or created or evolved in this time. And, you know, it's everything from drama to, as I say, you know, forms of political organization to Western philosophy to, you know the two major strains of Western philosophy, you know, Platonism and Aristotelianism. Mm. They it's all happening. I mean,
clues in the name.
Plato's in the and Aristotle in the fourth century, but you know, I think that you know, people get the idea. This is when it's all kicking off. And I think it's because it all kicked off in this time, and this is when you're getting all of those lovely statues that you alluded to of people.
the accurate statues, yeah.
Well, we can talk about that. They think that these people were these kind of supreme rational people who were, you know, in their sort of white garments, sitting around talking about mathematics or what have you.
Having abandoned the superstitions of their forebears.
But it was actually much weirder than that, and much more interesting. And to go to the point that I was going to say before you correctly told me that I needed to set the scene. What you have in Greece is you have, you know, certainly after the Persian Wars, this incredible sense of cultural unity. They know that, and it's defined. I can't remember who by. I think it might have been Herodotus, who said, "Well, we share language, we share gods, and we share, you know, forms of worship or something like that." I think he has a nice kind of triptych, but essentially, it's language and gods, and they have this incredibly strong sense, as I say, that they are a single cultural unity, but they are unbelievably politically divided, and they are at war with each other all the time. As in, they mock themselves for how poor they are at getting along with other Greeks. It's a kind of running it's a running thing in Greek culture that they just cannot agree.
Oh, and so they knew that this was weird.
They did know that this was weird, because they could look at Persia, which is this kind of, you know, incredibly vast empire, where within the empire usually there's peace. And there's an incredible variety of cultures and peoples and races and ethnicities and all this kind of thing. And they all live peacefully. The Greeks are looking at this and they're thinking, well, we're all the same people and we're just always killing each other. Like, always. Yeah.
And Greece isn't large.
It's tiny. Yeah. but within that kind of, it's a sort of rocky peninsula and archipelago, isn't it? You know, with you know, lots of islands and, you know, within that there's over 1,000 city states, and you know why? So there's a 1,000 individual polities.
And how big is a city in this?
It's tiny. It's tiny. You know, it's about the size of, you know, we're probably talking about 50,000 for the big ones. Mm. I mean, the very biggest might have 50,000 male citizens, and they'd be about a third of the population. So the very, very biggest ones, we're talking, you know, six figures, if there's no plague and there's no famine. But, you know, some of them are just a few thousand. And most of them are controlling basically probably a few square miles of sort of fertile farmland just around
enough
in a valley.
To feed their population. Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. And you know, they're just constantly fighting the people in the next valley. What is the result of this? Well, the result of this is that you have an incredible combination of the ability to communicate, because of course you're all part of the same culture, but also to compete. Because you're just in constant competition, and you're not only in competition with the city over the hill, you're in competition within the polis, because the Greeks have, you know, in within each city there's huge competition for political power all the time.
It's sort of like Renaissance Italy or even Renaissance kind of Western Europe, where even more intense, where it's a hollow.
This is exactly right. And the parallel is exactly right. And that is why, I mean, I'm jumping ahead here. This is the grand denouement of my argument. But, you know, why is it that an unbelievable amount of kind of cultural innovation comes out of Greece, technological innovation comes out of Greece, it's exactly the same reason that a further absolute ton came out of Enlightenment Europe. Mm. It's exactly the same conditions. You have just enough in common to be able to sort of communicate and spread ideas efficiently. You're all kind of close packed in together, so things spread incredibly quickly. But you're also all in competition. So there's that enormous drive to innovate. But I think that with the Greeks, it's not quite the same dynamic. It's more that because the Greeks, warfare is not really driving, say, technological innovation.
Hmm.
But what is happening is that because things are incredibly kaleidoscopic and divided politically, there was space for original thinkers. Because if you grew up in a city where, everyone worships the god on the hill. But you don't really think that the god on the hill is that much of a big deal. And you think that, the sun is made out of condensed vapor. Then it's fine because, whereas in most places you're going to be put to death by your neighbors in pretty short order, you can just wander over to the next valley. And once you've wandered over to the next valley, you'll find a load of people that can perfectly understand you. You know exactly how to kind of get along with them. But they're a completely different polity. So you wander in and to them, you're sort of a wandering sort of wise man. And you might be tolerated.
Yeah.
And if you're not tolerated in that one, you can go on to the next one. You might be tolerated there. And so what you get is this kind of phenomenon of peripatetic innovators sort of wandering around. And there's space for them to wander around.
Yeah, so it's like because, Plato where it's like, yeah, you either believe the correct things or we kill you. You believe the correct things, or you can leave, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. It might not even be as kind of crude as I've put it there with believe the right things or we'll kill you. It's more like that because there are so many different cities who all have completely different mindsets, they develop their own microcultures.
Mm.
And that seems to have been basically created this incredibly diverse and nutritious sort of series of petri dishes for sort of weirdness.
Yeah.
and then when the weirdness grew, it was able to kind of escape and go viral because no one person had complete political control and was able to enforce uniformity. And, when you look at all of these thinkers, it's remarkable how often they are moving around. They're not just growing up in one place and then staying there. They are, and it's remarkable how often the ones who do stay put are put to death by the city. I mean, Socrates being the absolute classic example.
Mm, of course, yeah. But of course, by moving around, you mean going 20 miles.
Yeah, or even even less. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's the fact that, it's mountains and sea. That's what Greece is, mountains and sea. So, you don't really have much space for growing crops. And that meant that they were incredible sailors because, of course, they've got to get food from the sea, but also they've got to trade. And also they've got to found colonies elsewhere when the population gets too great, which means that, again, there's a culture of traveling and discovery as well.
And I guess dealing with uncertainty and thinking on your feet. Like, you can't plan ahead too much if you're a naval power. That's what one of the theories behind Britain's, intellectual contribution is that we're a nation of seafarers, and you can plan all you want, but then a storm comes through or the wind changes direction. What are you going to do? Yeah.
Exactly. You have to be quick witted, but you also have to be extremely competent.
Yeah.
Or my thoughts on British sea power.
I won't go into that. We don't need to.
Please refer to previous episode. I think that there you've got one of the reasons why the Greeks are so unusual is because of these kind of unique conditions. And of course, ultimately, it comes from geography. It comes from the fact that it's mountainous, and it's the mountains that split the city-states up into tiny city-states. It's the mountains.
You don't need distance because they're hard to get from one to the other.
You can't. It's very hard to unify the peninsula because every single city, more or less, is surrounded by these enormous natural fortifications, and so you just can't do it. And you've got the tiny kind of isthmus that joins the Peloponnese to Attica, and then from Attica to get into the centre of Greece, you've got a tiny narrow strip of land, and it's just all choke points, and it's an absolute nightmare for any would-be unifier to unify. It can't be done until you get your superpowers, initially Macedon and then Rome coming in and sort of doing it just by overwhelming force. And that's why you get all this this crazy stuff coming out.
I say you've explained very well why they were so innovative, and you've given an overview of how these philosophical innovations were able to come about, but you haven't explained why they were weird, or that they were weird. They could still have achieved all these advances in political philosophy and be boring. They gave each other cuttlefish on the birth of their child. Okay, we put trees in our house over Christmas.
which is interesting and weird.
But it's not like it's not like weird. This is still compatible with them being very rational and down to earth, because they have to be, because their environment makes them that, and that's rewarded.
They're certainly not rational. Look at ancient religion.
Aren't these gods just like made up by the poets, and that they just give these sort of fun stories you can tell each other, but no one actually believes that Aphrodite is a god that controls them?
Wading into the sort of the subjective reality of ancient belief is a brave thing to do, because obviously it's very, very difficult to... I mean, how on earth anybody can state with authority what a sort of, Demetrius from sort of Attica actually subjectively believed is obviously incredibly hard at this distance. What we can say is that the Greek gods are always personalities. There's stuff that's written down in Linear B from the Mycenaean age, which seemed to show that, the predecessors of Athena and all this. So they were always personalities, which is a difference actually from Roman religion. The Romans seem to be more animist, but the Greeks were, they had belief in witches, huge belief in witchcraft. They believed in daimones, where we get our word demons from, which are sort of spirits, more animistic sort of spirits that are all around, everywhere, all the time. Not necessarily bad, but also not necessarily good. They sort of explain things like cattle dying, and or if it wasn't the witches, it might have been a daimon, stuff like that. You've got incredibly weird gods, incredibly weird. I mean, we've talked before about Dionysus.
Yeah.
The great releaser, drama is a form of worship of Dionysus. That's where it starts from. I mean, tragedy comes from the Greek words for like goat song. Goats,
today I learned.
Some people think, some people think the prize was a goat. Some people think that it's
prize.
Like the
for what?
The prize for the best play.
Okay.
Some people think that it's more, and I would count myself among these, that there's a link to Dionysus even in that, because of course you have the satyrs, the kind of half goat, half man creatures that represent sort of, I don't know, I suppose in a Freudian sense they represent libido, the sort of uncontrolled desire and lust, and they're boisterous, and they're sort of, they're sort of rough, uncivilized, libidinous kind of creatures. Drama is incredibly, in ancient Greece, is incredibly strange. They've got these terrifying masks on. They're doing it as an act of religious worship for the god who is present in the theater. His statue is there, it's being carried in. He's watching.
And okay, so that's not just decoration. That is.
No. He's there. And that, they're putting
Dionysus.
It on for him.
Dionysus,
he's placed in the, and it's happening, and it's something that is there to, I don't know, it's something that seems to have been, to have grown out of the democracy as well. And, you know, Aristotle analyzes it and says that, you know, what's happening is catharsis. And people think of catharsis as this kind of release of pressure, but that's a very Freudian thing that's basically from the Victorian era where everything was about steam engines, you know, so the brain is likened to a steam engine. Because it's always the best piece of technology that gets used as the metaphor for the mind, which is why we always think of our minds as computers.
Yeah.
But so, you know, when we say let off steam and, you know, I'm under pressure, that's all this kind of Victorian stuff that's lived on in the language. And so people in the Victorian age, they interpreted what Aristotle meant by catharsis as this kind of release of pressure, as if our minds were sort of steam engines that needed to vent like a train. But actually, you know, in the ancient Greek meaning, what it means is sort of tempering or purifying. It's a more metallurgical
word.
Because
that was their most advanced technology.
Yeah. And it seems that by watching this horror happen in a tragedy, sort of right in front of you, but also at a distance, you vicariously experience it, and that purges the impurities, i.e. the sort of the, you know, the psychological.
Okay, so we talk about the Greek invention of theatre. That isn't, you know, so some rational people getting together and working out how to you know, one up the guy telling the Iliad.
So absolutely,
how can we make
not.
This more immersive? How can we make this, you know, a better show? How can we make more money off it? It has actually emerged out of some kind of religious worship.
Yeah, and a very strange religious worship.
And I guess that this is probably closer to the direction which I thought you were going to take this, which is that if you look at a lot of great scientists, I mean, Isaac Newton is a famous example. Like they make these huge advances in technology or science or even philosophy and stuff like that, whilst believing in all sorts of occult stuff.
Alchemy, wasn't he? He was a great alchemist.
Yeah, he was an alchemist. And you see this a lot, and even to the modern day. I mean, in a previous episode, or maybe a future episode, depending on our release order, we talked about Jacques Vallée, who is a renowned computer scientist.
Friend of the show.
Yeah. who's all about UFOs. And you get a few, especially from kind of Californian tech culture. Jack Parsons is famous for being a follower of Aleister Crowley, whilst also being, you know, one of the foremost rocket scientists.
Aleister Crowley is another friend of the show,
and he seems to come up weirdly often.
just for the listeners, what is the relevance of Aleister Crowley?
He the self-styled wickedest man in the world.
Aldi. Sorry.
He kept inventing Satanist orders and rituals and thought he was an avatar of some Egyptian god and you know, things like that. But sadly, quite an unpleasant person as well. It wasn't just in a cool way. So the direction I thought it is: you need this kind of, you need more than rationality to actually advance things to where it hadn't been conceived before. And the advances these Greeks made weren't evolutionary. They weren't building on what had gone before. They were revolutionizing. And for that,
I can't think of that. I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, in a sense that to innovate, especially at this really kind of base layer of technology, you know, you really have to step beyond the bounds and the structures of what is known and what makes sense. You just have to step out into the void because you don't know, because it's uncharted. It's uncharted mental territory. And you just have to step out there. And what was happening in Greece is that you had these guys who were in all of these, you know, thousands of little, as I've characterized them, petri dishes of creativity. And they were stepping out in all directions.
Yeah.
And most of them went nowhere, and it sounds completely bonkers. Yeah. You know, so there was this guy, I think he's called Anaximenes, who thought that, I think as I alluded to before, that everything was made out of condensed vapor.
Nice.
And so, you know, the sun was just a particularly bright cloud, and the moon was a sort of a bright cloud, and it, you know, came up out of the sea. There was another guy who thought that every single day was a new sun. So the earth is kind of moving in a sort of, as like a constant conveyor belt.
Yeah.
And every day we just go underneath a new sun. And so that, you know, these guys were really thinking outside the box.
Yeah,
and then another guy thinks that, oh, actually, I think, who's equally crazily thinking outside the box, says, well, actually, I think that the, you know, the Earth is a sphere, that the sun is a huge piece of mass that's basically really hot because of its incredibly fast rotation, and that the moon doesn't emit its own light, it's just reflecting off the sun. And you know what, actually, you're not far off there. And, you know, you've got pretty far there. That's actually quite good. And then when you look at, when you look at Lucretius in his De Rerum Natura, obviously a Latin writer, you know, much later, but he's sort of putting together the sort of the greatest hits of Greek philosophy. What they managed to get to with just their just thinking about it is absolutely incredible. Like, that, you know, I think it's Empedocles. This comes from Empedocles, who was a Greek philosopher. We'll have to edit that out if that's wrong. I'm pretty sure it's Empedocles. It says that, well, you know, things must be made of atoms. Atom is sort of Greek for indivisible. So they called these kind of base units of matter atoms.
Yeah.
Things must be made of atoms. There must be a lot of empty space in between the atoms within any given substance. Because how else could sound travel through stone?
Mm.
And if you think about it, that sounds kind of, you kind of think, huh, wait, what? When you really think about that, that is 100% correct.
Yeah.
Like, it is absolutely dead on the money. And when you think about it, you're like, yeah, so actually you can figure out atomic theory just from thinking about something in a really clever way, but also in a kind of really outside the box kind of way. And, you know, so as I say, you're absolutely right. In order to make these innovations, you have to be going, you know, crazily in all different directions. And it's kind of like, you know, if you just throw darts in all different directions, eventually one's going to hit the bullseye. Yeah. And so you have to have the right cultural conditions where that's possible.
Yeah.
There's also the fact that they were all taking psychedelics at Eleusis as well.
Also that.
Yeah.
So do you think, because, I mean, there's a vibe that we live in a time of relative stagnation, that it's the fact there is no space for people to just go out on one and try stuff.
Do we live in a time of relative stagnation? What do you mean by that?
Well, I just don't feel like there's been a major revolution in thought or science for a few decades.
Oh, I don't know. I think there was a massive revolution in culture, certainly in the 60s. In the mid-20th century.
Yeah, no, and I think the 60s was the last time when people were able to be this weird.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? I mean, that was the whole San Francisco thing. It was a kind of hippie colony where people were experimenting with psychedelics and all these cults and things like that. And out of it came, you know, computers and rockets. And
yeah. I mean, one can argue that those came out of the Second World War as much as anything else, but...
Yeah.
I mean, it depends on how you look at it, doesn't it? Because on the one hand, you know, the rate of technological development, the rate of human technological power is still recursively increasing. You know, and the fact that we both remember a time before smartphones and we're only in our 30s, and you think about the absolute difference in society and culture and technology that alone represents, you know, for an ancient Greek, the rate of technological change is so slow that it was completely imperceptible. You know, they genuinely believed that the world had always been like it was in front of them and always would be. And, you know, that was still true really in the sort of 1500s. I mean, you take a Greek and you put them in the 1500s Greece, you know, that they're going to not be completely nonplussed. They're going to be pretty much at home. You put them in now. I mean, they're just not going to understand what's happening. It would be like us, you know, going and, you know, having a tea party with a culture mind. It's just...
Yeah, but I still think, I mean, I agree that the smartphone has had a huge impact, but the smartphone itself wasn't a revolution in terms of its creation. It was an evolution that just happened to trip past some threshold that just broke everyone's brains.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's all about the increase in... It's about the density of computing power, isn't it, in any given space. So, you know...
It's not like inventing drama or inventing political philosophy or... Inventing,
no, so, you know, so what you mean is kind of... You mean that we're stagnating in terms of inventing novel cultural modes or something like that?
Yeah, or just like... Things that change the paradigm in a way that Newton did or a way that Einstein did.
Well, I mean, was it immediately obvious to someone who was living in contemporaneously with Newton that the paradigm had just changed? I mean, I suppose that would be my question. I think that we think of paradigm shifts as happening, you know, sort of on a sixpence, but actually, you know, even very rapid paradigm shifts take decades. And I think that probably when you're living through those decades, it doesn't really feel like it.
Did the Greeks have a sense that they were living through a time when things were changing quickly?
I think that when great states rose and fell, that to them felt sort of epochal. So there were events that felt sort of significant in terms of history, like the Persian Wars, obviously, the sort of the fall of Athens or the defeat of Athens in the Peloponnesian War, and the conquest of Greece by Alexander, first of all, and then by the Romans. You know, they very much perceived these as kind of grand historical events that heralded in new and usually worse ages. Not the Persian Wars, but pretty much all the other ones. Sort of bad news. But I don't think that they had the same sense of cultural paradigm shift. Although I think we've got some evidence that under the Roman Empire, you know, some Greeks were disturbed by the Romanization of Greek culture. You know, they weren't happy about gladiatorial games being imported. They thought it was very infra-dig, but
vulgar, but
everybody bloody loved it, obviously. So it was very distressing for them.
A bit like Facebook, yeah.
Yeah. And I think, well, I suppose that Polybius, you know, he sets himself the task of explaining how it was that Rome came to dominate the Mediterranean in 50 years. So that's clearly a shocking event that needs explanation. But I suppose that the Athenians did have a sense that they had done something really quite special when they invented democracy. Mm. There was that sense there that they were doing something completely unique.
Okay, and needed that they to be. Created it.
They created it and, you know, it was theirs and, So, I don't know, yes and no. Is that a good answer? What's my answer to that? Yes, they did sometimes have the sense that there were paradigm shifts happening, but it's much slower, you know, and they're fewer and further between, I think, than in recent centuries.
Okay.
Because, you know, the Persian Wars is hundreds of years away from the Roman conquest of Greece. I mean, that's completed in 146 BC. I mean, you know, the Persian Wars is 498. They sort of kick off BC. Yeah. So, you know, it's a long time.
I'm surprised that Pythagoras hasn't come up in this conversation.
Well, yeah, I mean, Pythagoras, he's one of these kind of peripatetic wanderers, you know. Mm. And it seems that belief in the magical and mystical powers of numbers was very widespread. I mean, the Oracle of Delphi, there were three things inscribed above the entrance to the precinct. One is nothing too much. The other one was know thyself.
Yeah.
And then there was a sort of an epsilon, and nobody knew what the epsilon meant. But some people think it's linked to various systems of numerology. Anyway, the thing is that the belief that numbers were a way into understanding this kind of fundamental magic that underlay everything seems to have been a thing. And you can see Pythagoras in his theorem in that light, because when they said, I can't think of what the theorem is right now. Is it A squared plus B squared equals the root of C? Or whatever it is. I'm not a mathematician. Yeah. What is it? Go on, what is it? What's the thing? Pythagoras' theorem.
So a triangle.
Yeah.
That has.
You've got two sides. You can work out the third side. That's it, basically, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. See, I paid attention at school.
Yeah, yeah, you did very well. I think it needs a right angle one corner, but yeah.
Yeah. it's A squared plus B squared equals something to do with C squared or something, isn't it? Where the longer side is C, obviously. Yeah. Anyway.
The hypotenuse.
Where that would appear to show that numbers somehow underlay or the universe, because you can say, well, you can work out something fundamental. You can actually work out information that you didn't have from this prior information using numbers. And you can kind of see, I mean, you know, maths teachers will tell kids that maths is magical all the time. It is, I mean, it is magical, isn't it? I mean, it's in the sense that it gives you a sense of mastery or understanding over something that's very fundamental and otherwise hidden.
Yeah, and I mean, alphabets had the same impact on... If you read pre-Islamic poetry in the Arabian Peninsula, you know, they're aware of alphabets and words written down, and they fear them.
Yeah, well, the first things that Greeks seem to have written down is they wrote down on things, like they wrote down on pots. They said, like, I'm a pot on the pot. Or underneath the statue that says, you know, I am Chrysippus or something.
Yeah.
So it's like they were bringing things to life by writing on them. So again, it's that kind of that sense of magic. It brings something to life. It, you know, it creates theater life, or it creates a voice where there was none. And so, you know, the Pythagoras is not some sort of mathematician. He's a mystic.
Yeah.
If he existed at all. I mean, whoever he was, whatever man we choose to apply this name to, he was almost certainly a mystic.
Yeah. I thought he lived in a cave and was vegan.
Maybe. Yeah. Unlikely to be vegan. But, I mean, there were vegans, Orphic. Anyway, it's because they believed in... The vegans, it's because they believed in metempsychosis, the sort of the reincarnation. That's why they were vegetarian. Because it's like, if you eat a cow, you might be eating your, you know, great uncle Diogenes, which is not on. Anyway, it's a side. These kind of mathematical advances were almost certainly out of these sort of mystical number cults. Yeah. But we know that the Babylonians already had... I mean, it's quite clear now that you know, Pythagoras' clever rule was known.
Him, yeah.
No, it was known about before. But yeah. So you kind of have this you know, this cultural milieu in the Eastern Mediterranean, which the Greeks are very much part of, and they're constantly importing stuff, particularly from the East. And anything that comes in from the East has this kind of cultural capital and also mystique.
Yeah. Anything from far away, I think, is the answer.
Yeah. But also, you know, these Eastern civilizations were way older, and they were very grand, and they were wealthier. So they had all of that kind of cachet as well. It's absolutely the case that, you know, once again, you know, if you're there thinking of Pythagoras as this kind of rational mathematician existing in sort of 700 BC, that's absolutely not the case.
Okay, so I guess Pythagoras and like the ancient Greeks, you know, I already knew they were important, and it's not just they were important and they were weird. It's kind of they're important because they were weird.
I mean, and also their importance grew out of their weirdness. You couldn't have had their importance without their weirdness. I mean, we haven't even gone into the real weirdness of Greek religion. I mean, it's so weird. I mean, you know, they first of all, I mean, there's thousands of different versions. Well, I say thousands, I assume thousands, at least hundreds of different versions of Zeus. You know, you've got Zeus of that hill, we've got Zeus of that hill. You've got Zeus of hospitality, Zeus of the marketplace, Zeus of the fence. The fence is very important. So it divides up property, very important. There's a Zeus for it. And so the obvious question is that all students ask is... Well, how many Zeus's are? Is it all the same Zeus? Or is it different Zeus's? Yeah. And the Greeks had never asked that question. It's just not addressed.
Okay.
It seems to us like it's the elephant in the room.
But so they're the Greeks, important, they're weird, but they're also actually not relatable in a way that we don't really anticipate going into it. Because you read Plato's dialogues and it's quite relatable, but there's this undercurrent there.
It's only relatable because you're a direct kind of intellectual descendant of Plato, fundamentally. I mean,
we're quite weird as well in our own way. Yeah.
I mean, exactly. But when you read his, you know, his story of the cave, you know, to explain his theory of the forms, it's completely mad. It's completely mad. You know, there's this perfect universe behind it all, where the forms exist, and everything in this universe is just an imperfect reflection. You know, some people, I've read scholars that have argued that this was all derived from his experience at Eleusis. That this is basically, you know, his story of coming up out of the cave of shadows and into the light of truth.
Wait, that was him on psychedelics?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is where it all comes from.
And so that is relatable. So.
But it goes to the heart of why if you're a Mesoamerican and somehow this was translated into your language, you know, you're just going to be sitting there like, what on earth are you talking about?
I think that that's probably most students' reaction to this. But
we're preconditioned to thinking in terms of...
We've also all had an hour of someone explaining why.
Yeah, but also, I mean, just look at... I mean, Platonism underlies Christianity. I mean, we're all, with our Christian heritage, we are preconditioned to think in these terms, that there's this world, but this isn't the kind of the real world. This is a kind of corrupted, sort of slightly problematic world. Mm. And then once, you know, it's possible through acting in the right way or through dying to get to the perfect world, and that's the kind of the point. You know, we're preconditioned to think in those terms, but that's only because... we're the descendants of Plato. You know, if you somehow were to find someone who's not grown up in that tradition, and obviously that tradition has now almost entirely conquered the globe one way or another, but if you were to find someone who was untouched by it, they'd think it was completely bonkers. Because it is. you know.
Fair, yeah.
It's completely mad.
So I've been subtly trying to wrap up for the last 5 minutes. Do you have any closing thoughts on this matter?
Do I have any closing thoughts on this matter? I wish I could have talked more about Corinth. I've really got myself to blame.
That was a bit of a misdirection there.
Yeah. A bit of misfire. Prostitutes of the temple of Corinth. closing thoughts. The Greeks were not this kind of rational race of people. Most of them were peasants. Most of them had an extremely confusing set of beliefs. They didn't even have a word for religion, you know, because religion is just part of
it wasn't
existence. Yeah. It wasn't separate. It's part of everything, and everything is weird. And all of the rituals are kind of strange. I mean, you know, you've got thonic sacrifices where you're burying the carcass of pigs in the fields for the gods of the underworld and stuff like that. And, you know, it's all totally normal. You've got the women going off up to the mountainside covered in, you know, animal skins to, you know, do their sort of rites for Dionysus. And, you know, you've got incredibly odd forms of religious worship, such as drama and athletics. You've got this unbelievable state of affairs of constant warfare, just constant warfare between these thousands of city-states, every single one with a separate constitution and a separate, you know, nationalist, as we would call it, but anachronistic, but sort of nationalist story that they tell themselves about their own city, about most of it, almost all of which is lost. It's an incredibly bewildering, kaleidoscopic, strange world where the sea, the kind of the beyond the mists of the horizon, there are cyclops and there are harpies and there are monsters and there are, you know, but there are also these incredibly ancient kingdoms towards the east. And yeah, it's a really weird, strange, sunlit, sparkling, dark, scary world. trying to get back into the mindset of ancient Greece when you really strip away all of the millennia that of our kind of retrospective perceptions is a very rewarding task. And I haven't even spoken about the art yet. I mean, the whole reason why we have an image of the perfect male physique in the way that we do, that is a Greek image. It's a Greek image. They invented it. You know, all these guys in the gym pumping iron, they are being Greeks. It's a Greek thing. They invented gyms. They spend all day in the gym. Because the perfect body is the perfect form, which is, it's symmetrical, it's perfect. It's a way of a man becoming like a god.
Form of worship.
Very strange.
Okay, I'm sold.
Very good.
The Greeks are not boring.
Very good. Greeks are not boring.
I shall read more.
I can suggest some strange things to read. But yeah, I know that you don't think that they're boring. I know that you're being kind to set me up.
Well, in Siberia, two wolves. One thinks the Greeks are boring. One thinks they're weird and awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there are other people that are just as weird and awesome. They're just weird and awesome in different ways.
Yeah.
You know, the Greeks are our weird and awesome ancestors. I think that's what I like about them. They're ours, and they are just as weird as anybody else's. And I'll fight anyone who's over the line.
Well, on that note,
yeah.
Bring this to a close.
All right.